Welcome. You are listening to AfterSight. This recording is intended solely for individuals who are blind or have low vision.
Thank you for joining us for the Arapaho County News, read by Tim Elliott. This is being recorded on April 20th, 2024. Today, we will be reading the following main articles. 12 students and teacher killed in Columbine School shooting remembered at 25th anniversary vigil. By Colleen Slevin, Associated Press. Teaching Columbine Strong in Aurora. By Ann Shimka, Colorado Chalkbeat. Devon Williams' arraignment postponed a final time pending possible resolution. By Elizabeth Slay. Inglewood teacher shares sage lessons about sustainability agriculture at school. Also by Elizabeth Slay. Hoping to avoid corporate takeover, Meadowood Village residents try to buy their mobile home park. By Nina Joss. Denver has First Fridays. Now Littleton has Final Fridays as a way to bring excitement to downtown. Also by Nina Joss. And following up with miscellaneous articles. 12 students and teacher killed in Columbine school shooting remembered at 25th anniversary vigil. The kids that he saved now have children, and those children will have children, so generations from now people will know they exist because of his bravery. A girl who wrote to God in her diaries. A boy with learning disabilities who was just learning to like who he was. And a teen who would spend every free minute fishing were among the 13 victims of the Columbine High School shooting, remembered during a vigil Friday on the eve of the 25th anniversary of the shooting, that was the worst the nation had seen at that time. As small candles flickered on 13 empty chairs, short biographies of Columbine students Rachel Scott, Kyle Velasquez, Corey DePuter, and the other victims were read one by one. After each, the crowd of about 150 people replied together, "Never forgotten," and a bell tolled. The youngest killed in the attack that has inspired dozens of copycat shootings was Stephen Curnow, 14. The oldest was teacher Dave Sanders, 47, who shepherded students out of the cafeteria to safety and was shot as he tried to get students upstairs into classrooms. The others killed were Casey Bernal, Kelly Fleming, Matt Ketchter, Daniel Mauser, Dan Rohrbaugh, Isaiah Scholes, John Tomlin, and Lauren Townsend. Sanders' daughter, Connie Sanders, said her father changed the world forever by saving hundreds of students. The kids that he saved now have children, and those children will have children, so generations from now, people will know they exist because of his bravery, she said before the ceremony began. The gathering, set up by advocates including gun safety organizations, was the main public event marking Saturday's anniversary, which is more subdued than previous milestone years. In addition to remembering those killed, the vigil at a church near the state capitol also drew attention to those who were wounded and those who survived the shooting but suffered trauma. Daniel Mauser's father, Tom Mauser, decided to set up the vigil after learning school officials did not plan to organize a large community event as they did on the 20th anniversary. Mauser, who became a gun safety advocate after the shooting, urged the crowd of about 150 people gathered at a church across from the state capitol never to forget the victims of Columbine and to take some kind of action to reduce gun violence. And most importantly, we ask you to never forget the victims of Columbine, the slain, the injured, the traumatized, and their families, and especially never forget those who lost their lives, said Mauser, wearing his son's sneakers, a tradition he reserves for special occasions. President Joe Biden, in a statement issued Saturday, said his administration has taken numerous steps to try to curb the senseless violence that has shattered some 400 schools since Columbine, including the creation of the White House Office of Gun Violence Prevention. I've met with countless families who've lost loved ones because of gun violence. Their message is always the same. Do something, the statement said. My administration will continue taking action, but Congress must do their part. We need universal background checks, a national red flag law, and we must ban assault weapons and high-capacity magazines. Former Arizona Congresswoman Gabby Giffords, who began campaigning for gun safety after she was nearly killed in a mass shooting, attended and spoke about her long recovery, drawing a comparison to the small steps needed to make change in the world. Change doesn't happen overnight, and we can't do it alone. Join me. Let's move ahead together, she said, drawing a standing ovation. Nathan Hawkhalter, whose sister Anne Marie was paralyzed after she was shot at Columbine, spoke about being trapped in a classroom at the school with about 30 students as they heard gunfire nearby. They were rescued about 4 hours later by SWAT officers, who he said frisked them 5 times. 6 months later, his mother, who had bipolar disorder, took her own life after asking to look at a gun in a pawn shop and shooting herself there. I just want to use this moment to let everyone know that it's okay to ask for help. Whatever your situation is, whether either as a survivor 25 years later or someone struggling with any part of their life, these things come in waves and they can hit you when you least expect it. You should all know that we're all here for you and that you're not alone, Hawkhalter said. This story has been corrected to say Hawkhalter's mother asked to look at a gun in a pawn shop before shooting herself. Teaching Columbine Strong in Aurora. Aurora Central teacher Heather Martin survived Columbine. She's spreading the strength to her students. When Heather Martin was a senior in high school, she survived the Columbine High School shooting that killed 12 students and one teacher in Littleton. Even as she tried to move on with her life, she carried the trauma of that day inside her, often in ways that surprised her. The following year, during a community college class, she burst into tears during a routine fire drill, confused and embarrassed by her emotional reaction. I hadn't remembered until that very moment that the fire alarm had been going off while I was barricaded for 3 hours before the SWAT team came in, she said. She also struggled with panic attacks, an eating disorder, and insensitive comments from instructors. Eventually, Martin dropped out of college. Today, Martin is a high school English teacher in Aurora who prioritizes making her students feel safe and giving them the tools to understand and cope with trauma. She's also the executive director of the Rebels Project, a nonprofit that supports survivors of mass tragedy. In March, she attended the State of the Union address as a guest of U.S. Rep. Jason Crow, a Democrat who represents Aurora and region. Martin, who teaches at Aurora Central High School, talked to Chalkbeat about how she rediscovered her desire to teach after leaving college, what calming techniques she teaches students, and why she loves home visits. Was there a moment when you decided to become a teacher? When I was in elementary school, my friends and I used to play school when we would study for tests. We alternated being the teacher, and I think that really laid the foundation of me wanting to teach in some way. After the shooting at Columbine in 1999, I struggled a lot with trauma while attending community college and ended up dropping out. One day, while filming some B-roll for a documentary called Grieving in a Fishbowl, I was asked to flip through my high school yearbook. I found where my English teacher had signed, "I hope you major in English and become a teacher. Your students would love you," it read. It seems I had forgotten for a while where I wanted to go, but I eventually found my way back. After 10 years and a long road of healing, I went back to school, finished my degree, and earned my teaching license. How did your trauma manifest during your initial college experience? I had extreme anxiety and unpredictable panic attacks, or at the time I thought they were unpredictable. I developed an eating disorder, started ditching and failing classes, and even tried recreational drugs. I attributed many of these things to normal college behavior and refused to acknowledge that it had anything to do with the shooting. I told myself, it's been months. I should be fine. I had an English teacher assign a final essay that had a prompt related to school safety or guns in schools. When I finally worked up the courage to tell her why I couldn't do the essay, she said it was required and if I didn't do it, I would fail the class. I never went back to that class and ultimately ended up failing. I was already questioning my right to be traumatized, and her dismissal was extremely harmful. When I took English again, I was assigned to write a 2-to-3-page personal narrative about an event that impacted me. That was about a year after the shooting, so I decided to actually tackle writing about it. I wrote upwards of 10 pages. On the due date, I printed my essay and brought it to the instructor. I told her how long it was, but I did not tell her the content. I wanted reassurance that the length was okay. She said she would probably just grade me on the first few pages. Again, I felt dismissed and that my experience didn't matter. And again, this amplified my questions about whether I had any right to feel and be traumatized. Again, I failed English class because I stopped attending. My students love to hear that I failed English class twice in college. What was it like to attend the State of the Union address? The invite from my congressman, Crow, came as a surprise, and I was very excited and even a bit nervous to attend. Every person I met was very interesting and compassionate regarding long-term recovery from trauma. Congressman Crow and his staff were wonderful and did an excellent job of helping get the message out about the need for long-term support. How did your own experience in school influence your approach to teaching? I was a student who often felt like I wasn't seen or noticed in school. I did just enough to stay off everyone's radar, never a super high or super low performer. As a teacher now, I look for students who may feel like I felt, and am sure to connect with them as best I can. Also, obviously, the shooting and my subsequent healing journey helped to drive my mission to make my classroom and school community as safe as I can, both in the physical sense and the emotional sense. Tell us about a favorite lesson you teach. I call it Mirror Poem. We began by comparing Shakespeare's sonnet 130, My Mistress' Eyes Are Nothing Like the Sun, to sonnet 18. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? We focus on which is the truer love poem. After many discussions, we decide which one represents a mirror. The answer always depends on what students view as a mirror's purpose, so the responses are excellent. My favorite part is that after we read and analyze, students write their own poem using a mirror as a metaphor to describe how they see themselves and or how others see them. The poems are incredible, and reading them never ceases to amaze me at how brilliant they are. Tell us about the Rebels Project. I co-founded the organization in 2012 with three other classmates from Columbine in the aftermath of the Aurora Theater shooting. It's named for the Columbine High School mascot. We wanted to provide support that we didn't have access to after the shooting at our school, a space to share, connect, and heal alongside others who understand what it's like to experience a similar event. Everybody on our leadership team has experienced a mass trauma themselves, which drives our decisions in every project we develop. We connect survivors from all across the world. We hold support meetings, travel to impacted communities, educate the public on ways to support trauma survivors, and host an annual survivor retreat. We do this all as volunteers. How do you incorporate trauma-informed practices into your classes? Recently, we read The Kite Runner, which has some disturbing content that may provoke some anxiety or trauma responses. We practice grounding techniques before reading. Then I offer opportunities to use some of the techniques as we read. These can include coloring, folding, origami, deep breathing exercises, and bilateral movements that use both sides of the body together, such as tapping, pacing, or walking. Another way I practice this is through good old-fashioned modeling. I point out when I'm feeling activated, how I notice it, what it feels like, and how I ground myself. I'm also very open about my healing journey. I teach seniors, so it's age appropriate that I share my story about surviving a school shooting and how I struggled in the aftermath. I am honest about some of the struggles I still have, even 25 years later. I think it's so important that they know that healing doesn't always mean you get over it. It's more about working through it. Experiencing trauma changes us, and I feel that acknowledging that change is important. Tell us about a memorable time, good or bad, when contact with a student's family changed your perspective or approach. At our school, we conduct home visits to help connect with the parents and guardians. These are always positive, basically pumping up the kiddo and sharing how amazing they are. I've had such wonderful visits with parents who come from various countries around the world, including Afghanistan, Republic of the Congo, Mexico, and Burma. I absolutely love connecting with them and learning more about the lives of the students. What are you reading for enjoyment? Currently, I'm reading a few books. Yes, I'm one of those weirdos that can read multiple books at a time. They include The Heaven and Earth Grocery Store by James McBride, and Skyward Series by Brandon Sanderson, and Bruce Springsteen's memoir, Born to Run, because he is my favorite. Teacher, student surprise Aurora student with news he'd won $40,000 Amazon scholarship. He specifically thanked his engineering teacher. Without her, none of this would be possible, by Chris Deneau. Inside Grandview High School's lecture hall, Bruno Denegri sat with his classmates while listening to several Denver-based Amazon engineers talk about their careers. While students enjoyed asking the engineers advice, it was all a ruse to surprise Denegri with a scholarship. Denegri won the Amazon Future Engineer Scholarship. It is awarded to students who want to pursue a computer engineering degree and for being a part of an underrepresented or underserved community, according to a press statement from Amazon. The scholarship includes mentorship, mental health resources, an emergency grant fund for unexpected financial obligations, and the $40,000 scholarship, which will be distributed evenly over 4 years. The announcement was met with an explosion of vibrant confetti, a surprise visit from his aunts, and cheers from his classmates. "My teachers are the reason this is all happening," Denegri said. He specifically thanked Ann Lujan, his engineering teacher who was among those who wrote the recommendation letter for this scholarship. Without her, none of this would be possible. In his essay for the scholarship, Denegri wrote that he wants to become an engineer so that he can improve the infrastructure in his home country of Peru and help it grow out of poverty. With better infrastructure, people wouldn't have to live without water and electricity in isolated communities. This way, Peru could become a less centralized country, similar to the U.S., where people don't have to come to the capital for a better life. With help from the scholarship, I could further my education and get the necessary degrees to accomplish this dream, he wrote. Denegri's dad is a diplomat and lives in Lima, Peru. Denegri and his family came to the United States for his dad's job. But when his dad had to go back to Peru, Denegri made the difficult decision to stay and pursue an American education. While his parents couldn't attend in person, his aunts FaceTimed them so they could still experience it. "Thank you for believing in me. I know it's been hard for both of us, but it worked out," he said to his parents. He also thanked his aunts for supporting him while he's been living in the United States. Denegri plans on attending the Colorado School of Mines. He is one of four students in the state who won the Amazon Future Engineer Scholarship. Hundreds of others around the country were also awarded the scholarship. Applications for the scholarship will open again in the fall of 2024. Devon Williams' arraignment postponed a final time pending possible resolution. Inglewood School Board members' next court appearance set for May 21st. Inglewood Board of Education member Devon Williams' arraignment for a 2019 felony charge of car theft has been postponed for a final time. Adams County District Court Judge Patrick H. Pugh said during an April 9th court appearance that the court would postpone the arraignment one more time pending potential resolution. The Adams County District Court docket shows Williams' next court appearance is at 8:30 a.m. on May 21st in Division G. Pugh said if a resolution is not met on May 21st, then the case will go to trial. Williams is represented by attorney Michael McCullough. The 2019 car theft allegations against Williams led to the issuance of an arrest warrant in 2020. The Glendale Police Department confirmed that Williams turned himself in to their agency for the outstanding warrant on November 6th of last year. Meg Froelich, who represents Inglewood in the Colorado House, told the Inglewood Herald in December that she believes a felony conviction while in office could result in Williams' removal from the Inglewood School Board. Currently, the law states in CRS 22-31-129, a school director office shall be deemed to be vacant upon the occurrence of any one of the following events prior to the expiration of the term of office. E. If the person who is duly elected or appointed is found guilty of a felony, Froelich said. Matt Cook, Director of Public Policy and Advocacy for the Colorado Association of School Boards, said in an email April 9th that the statute continues to state what the proceedings of removal would look like. The statute then states, at the next Board of Education meeting immediately following the occurrence of any conditions specified in subsection 1 of this section, the Board of Education of the district shall adopt a resolution declaring a vacancy in the school director's office, and the Board of Education of the school district in which the vacancy occurs shall appoint a person to fill the vacancy within 60 days after the vacancy has occurred, Cook said. If the appointment is not made by the board within the 60-day period, the president of the board shall forthwith appoint a person to fill the vacancy. The appointment shall be evidenced by an appropriate entry in the minutes of the meeting, and the board shall cause a certificate of appointment to be delivered to the person so appointed. A duplicate of each certificate of appointment shall be forwarded to the Department of Education. The April court appearance happened weeks after a reimbursement dispute between Williams and other members of board and after the 18th Judicial District Attorney's Office found no crime had been committed in an investigation regarding a criminal complaint Williams filed against Inglewood City Attorney Tamara Niles and City Manager Sean Lewis in February. Williams ran unopposed for the board in November. His candidacy and members on the board became controversial after the Inglewood Herald revealed in October that Williams had two previous felony convictions, a finding of bad faith in a civil lawsuit, an outstanding arrest warrant, and an ongoing felony car theft case. Inglewood teachers share sage lessons about sustainability, agriculture at school. Sage Pathway at Colorado's finest brings plant animal science to life. Habitats created for various types of animals line the walls. Unique plants from all over the world grow in a greenhouse. This is the human-created and cared-for world of the Sustainable Agriculture and Green Energies Pathway classroom in Inglewood. The program, known as SAGE, is where students at Colorado's finest high school of choice learn about sustainability, the science of plants, proper care of animals, and more. Scott Wallace, the leader of the SAGE pathway, helped start the program 8 years ago, part of his 32-year career at Inglewood Schools. Wallace said his experience in the summers working in landscaping for 31 years led to his selection as the SAGE educator. The SAGE pathway is part of the Natural Resources pathway for the State Agriculture Program, and in my instance, what I do is I teach kids plant science, horticulture, landscaping, and I teach them about erection, Wallace said. Wallace said the pathway is an important program for students because it teaches them useful skills such as working with soil and building things. Additionally, Wallace said he is teaching his students important methods of sustainability, such as water preservation, pollination gardening, and alternative planting options. In my students' lifetime, they're going to have to make a choice of whether they want a lawn or do they want a shower, Wallace said. So, making sure they have choices when it gets to that point. Wallace said over the years, many of his students have taken what he has taught them and gone on to start their own landscaping businesses, furthered their education in agriculture, or go into environmental engineering. SAGE student and 17-year-old Randall Coyle started taking classes this year and really enjoys the hands-on learning of the program. I really love animals, and I really love plants, and I really love being around them, Coyle said. I feel like I can't really remember stuff just from watching videos or reading articles, and it's really helpful to my personal education to be able to actually see stuff in action, like with the plants growing and everything. Plants and animals are a big part of Coyle's life, who also hopes to be a large animal veterinarian after high school. Coyle feels the program is important because it creates pathways students might not know they can take. I feel like it really opens up a lot of opportunities for kids who wouldn't even think that they would want a career in agriculture or to do with plants and animals because they just don't know what it's like, Coyle said. When he first began the SAGE program, Wallace said he initially focused on animals to attract students. However, over the years, he has focused more on plant education with some education on proper care and maintenance for certain animals. The kids actually are learning to really love and to understand all the nuances of how cool plants are, Coyle said. Maureen Bangs, a 15-year-old SAGE student, said she initially joined the program for the credits, but her interest for the subject evolved. The science that we're doing now, the agriculture, we can apply more to real-world stuff and how to figure things out and learn more about plants and how we can help our environment, Bang said. Bang said while she won't necessarily go into agriculture, she feels this program has influenced how she will treat the environment going forward. It's helped me to understand things I can do to help our environment and to live in a more sustainable way, Bang said. Wallace hopes to evolve the program and offer more specific landscaping classes for students to earn certificates in addition to the sciences. For more about the SAGE pathway, visit cfhsc.englewoodschools.net/programs/SAGE. How Columbine Changed Us. 25 years later, the tragedy is a study of recovery, resilience, and triumph. By Michael D. Ioanna. 25 years have passed since that April day that etched sorrow into the hearts of Columbine High School. Two armed students took the lives of 12 of their peers and a cherished teacher and then their own lives. The reverberations of that tragic day have rippled through the years, leaving a sad narrative of killers and victims often repeated in the mainstream media. But what that narrative misses is Columbine's story of recovery, resilience, and triumph. It is in the school's very fabric where the emphasis is that every individual, from the principal to the first-day freshman, matters. As Columbine sophomore Madison Price told us, it's just the kind of thing that you can feel. It's kind of a soft finding for a newsroom that spent months parsing through stories of grief and perseverance in our interviews with survivors, past and present school officials, teachers, security experts, and even media critics. Our newsroom sought the answer to a simple question. How has the 1999 Columbine shooting changed the school over the years, and everything else? On one hand, nothing has changed. Gun violence is rampant in the United States. Take, for instance, the stunning tally of deaths and injuries provided by the Atlas of American Gun Violence, tracking incidents across the country down to the neighborhood level. Such an atlas is only necessary because of the almost daily barrage of headlines chronicling shootings. Yet some are so large and horrific that everyone knows them by name, like Sandy Hook, Marjorie Stoneman Douglas, and Robb Elementary in Uvalde, Texas. The specter of violence is woven into the lives of children in schools at an early age. And schools across the country have increased security measures in the years since the Columbine shooting, which took the lives of students Casey Bernal, Stephen Kernow, Corey DePuder, Kelly Fleming, Matthew Ketchter, Daniel Mauser, Daniel Rorbo, Rachel Scott, Isaiah Schulz, John Tomlin, Lauren Townsend, and Kyle Velasquez, and teacher William Dave Sanders. The Jefferson County School District, which oversees the high school, points to classroom doors that lock from the inside. There are single-point entry systems at schools that ensure students, staff, and visitors pass through controlled checkpoints. Add to that security cameras, once a rarity, metal detectors, and scanners. Much of the changes are meant to ferret out people carrying guns. Yet our reporting did not take us to the raging debates over guns, like whether background checks are enough or if teachers should be armed. Instead, we explored how chaos among rescuers during the Columbine incident led to improved coordination today, working to bridge gaps to make all schools safer. And we looked at the media's role during and after the shooting. One harsh takeaway from University of Colorado Boulder professor Elizabeth Skews was that news coverage of shootings can desensitize Americans and even be harmful to survivors. Knowing that helps explain the goals of Jefferson County Schools at the district's recent media day for press organizations looking to report on the 25th anniversary of the tragedy. Reporters who went to that event heard many of the same things we learned in our reporting, which often involved initially reluctant sources opening up to trust our reporters and editors with their stories. They wanted us and our readers to know that the shooting doesn't define Columbine. Instead, what defines it is a kind of indomitable spirit that emerged and evolved with intentionality since 1999. It plays out for many every April 20th, the anniversary of the shooting and the school's day of service, now in its eighth year. We have turned that day into something so positive, teacher Mandy Cook told us, and that is what I am most proud of, is making sure that our current students know how to be better humans in the world, instead of this awful, tragic thing that happened to us. And Cook knows. She was a student at the school in 1999 and is among three survivors we interviewed who returned to the school to help it turn the page of the adversity to a brighter chapter. We found a community guided by those who became united in shared pain and with a fierce determination to heal. In that regard, no name came up more often than former principal Frank DeAngelis, who led the school, its staff, and generations of students out of the shadows of tragedy. People said that Columbine really needed me. I needed them, he said. For many, he is a beacon of hope, even in his retirement, as he aids others affected by similar hardships. Now, as it has been for decades, Columbine is just another high school. People look forward to football games. They're studying for tests. Students are discovering who they are and who they might be when they become adults. To Chris Welch, a student at the time of the shooting who is now a teacher at Columbine, It's all very ordinary, except for one thing. We exist to extend the notion that one can recover, he said, that the awful things that happen to us are outside of our control, but how we respond to those awful things is totally within our control. Columbine is a symbol of hope, he said, not only to itself, but well beyond. If you are determined to overcome the things that happen to you, you can do that, he said. Hoping to avoid corporate takeover, Meadowood Village residents tried to buy their mobile home park. There was not an empty seat in the Littleton City Council chambers at a recent meeting as over a dozen passionate seniors took turns sharing stories about how they love their mobile home community. Worried that a corporate bid to take ownership of Meadowood Village could break apart their community, they asked the city for money to help them purchase the land instead. Several dozen residents from the mobile home park filled the room. The residents, mostly older folks, recently received notice of a corporation's intent to buy the park. If we are purchased by a large corporation, they will only look at their bottom line, not at my neighbors or myself, one resident said at the meeting. If we own Meadowood, we can take pride in taking care of what's ours. Shortly after the Meadowood residents heard about the potential sale of their park, they started taking action. A Colorado law offers mobile home park residents 120 days after notice of a potential sale to make their own offer to buy the park. Resident Sandy Cook said residents have formed a business called Meadowood Cooperative that includes all but a few of the park's 121 residents. Our goal here is to not let one resident have to move because they can't afford to stay here, she said. That's why it got so critical for us to assure that we stay the community we are. It's a common story in Colorado and other parts of the nation, where large, out-of-state corporate and institutional investors increasingly purchase mobile home parks. When the ownership change, it often means hikes in what residents pay. At Meadowood Village, residents have seen increasing costs for years, they said. In the face of a potential sale, they also are unsure if the new owner even wants to keep the park, and they fear the potential for redevelopment of the land. With housing that's affordable, hard to come by across the metro area, including Littleton, mobile homes are often a catch for all those who otherwise have few alternatives. They are considered the largest source of unsubsidized housing that is affordable in the nation. On average, a mobile home in the U.S. costs approximately $127,000, whereas a site-built home costs about $413,000, according to the Manufactured Housing Institute, a national trade organization. On top of the cost of the mobile home, residents pay fees for the land their house sits on. Cook said the average rent in Meadowood Village is $850 to $900 a month. With many Meadowood Village residents being low income, including many veterans and disabled folks, the idea of higher fees is concerning. Several residents at the city council meeting spoke about their lack of other housing options if their homes become unaffordable. If we have this big developer come in, I have no place to go, one resident said. I can't afford any of the housing that they have here in Denver or anywhere in Colorado, so I don't have a plan B. The cooperative elected a 5-member board and got to work. Cook is the operations manager and has been taking charge of grants. She said the residents are also working with Thistle, an organization that helps mobile home park residents purchase their parks. The cooperative is now in the process of gathering money for a down payment. One day, you or your loved ones may be in our shoes, and we hope and pray no one would ever turn their backs on you, one resident said to the council. We are depending on you to step up and give us the help and support that we desperately need. Cook did not disclose how much money the cooperative needs for the down payment, but one public commentator made a specific request of $2.6 million from the city to go towards the cause. The cooperative is also asking for financial support from Arapahoe County and the Colorado Department of Local Affairs, Cook said. Deputy City Manager Mike Gent said the city is exploring all possibilities to see if there is a way it can help. We heard very eloquently from so many residents that they love their community, he said. It's really easy to want to do the work that we're doing right now. This is something that staff really feel strongly about. Trying to evaluate every possible strategy that can be used here. He noted, however, that even if the cooperative gets the money it needs for the down payment, it doesn't guarantee the residents would be able to own the land. What follows would still be a challenging and uncertain process before anything would be finalized, he said. Certainly, we're all motivated to find a solution, he said. It's just, unfortunately, not nearly as straightforward as some of the other services we provide. Councilmember Gretchen Ryden requested that staff also look at options for providing rental assistance or making zoning changes to prevent potential future redevelopment of the land. The Meadowood residents spoke of their community as a special place, where neighbors know each other and help each other out. One resident said a group of neighbors meets for coffee on Monday mornings to see how they can help each other throughout the week and share jokes. They said they are a part of the Littleton community, with many active members of the Buck Community Recreation Center and others who enjoy the Bemis Public Library bookmobile, and they don't want to have to move. We stick together, and we're trying to save our own community, one resident said. The reason why you have so many people at this meeting is because we're this close to not being able to stay there. Cook said the residents have until mid-June to make an offer on the land. Gent said the city will have an update for residents at the next study session on April 23rd. Denver has First Fridays. Now Littleton has Final Fridays as a way to bring excitement to downtown. On a Friday evening in March, a young boy sold handmade origami in a boutique. His father played vinyl records nearby. Patrons shopped around, munched on snacks, and enjoyed the ambience before moving on to the next shop. It was a Final Friday, a monthly event that a group of local business owners launched to bring more activity to historic downtown Littleton. The idea is similar to Denver's First Friday art walks on Santa Fe Drive, except it happens on the last Friday of each month and features more shops than galleries. About 15 to 20 shops and restaurants stay open for the action from 5 p.m. to 8 p.m. to create a fun atmosphere. There are specials and discounts to be had, complimentary snacks and drinks to sample, and random activities and pop-ups like the origami stand. There was even a decorate your own hat station one month. Jesse Mullins, owner of J. Claire's Women's Fashion, is one of the business owners who helped start Final Fridays. As much as this is for us and for our downtown and for our economy and for small business and all those beautiful things, it's also for the guests, she said. It's for the residents. It's for the kids. It's for whomever. It's for memories and experience and having fun. The group that started Final Fridays currently consists of six women who own shops on Main Street, South Prince Street, West Alamo Avenue, and South Nevada Street. They started putting on the events last summer as a way to bring excitement in the wake of the COVID-19 pandemic. The idea was to have a bunch of small, fun things happening throughout downtown to inspire people to wander and explore different shops, said Maggie Drake, who owns Colorado Frame and Savvy Stuff. They choose to host the event on the last Fridays of the month instead of First Fridays, so as not to compete with similar events in Denver and other nearby cities. They realize that when they collaborate with each other, instead of competing, they all do better as businesses. We believe that rising tides lift all boats, said Tiffany Norton, who owns Jumper Seed Mercantile. The group communicates with local businesses through in-person conversations and flyers and is interested in having as many businesses participate in the events as possible. For many of the women, finding a community of business owners who want to support each other has been a highlight of the initiative. Running a business can be exhausting, hard work, they said, and finding a community of support has been a game changer for them. I think it's really cool to know that we have each other's backs, Norton said. We're helping each other out, like this is what I've been looking for 3 years. Other organizing business owners include Raina Furby from Sweet Fire Boutique, Kelsey Riley from Elsewhere Collective, and Jody Clark from Lollygag Antiques and Boutique. As the weather gets warmer, the women said they plan to start having more artists involved in the events, potentially with people painting outside along the streets. In May, they also plan to have poetry performances. The Littleton Downtown Development Authority supported the group in getting a banner on Main Street to advertise the events, and the Little Merchants Association helped fund the first few monthly events. At this point, the business owners said they are largely funding the initiative on their own. The next Final Friday will take place from 5 to 8 p.m. on April 26th. Visitors can visit the group's Instagram page at final_Fridays_Littleton to see a lineup of participating businesses each month. As South Suburban District Board Chair resigns, Director promises transparent process to fill vacancy by Nina Joss. The South Suburban Park and Recreation District is kicking off a process to fill a vacancy after its board chairperson, Susan Pye, suddenly resigned Wednesday. The process for filling the vacancy will differ from the last time the board was in the situation, with the addition of interviews and publicly available candidate applications. The changes follow criticisms the district faced regarding transparency during its vacancy process in 2023, following the unexpected death of board member Dave Lawful. This time around, spokesperson Becky Grubb said the district will post completed applications in advance of candidate interviews, which will be conducted publicly. South Suburban Executive Director Rob Hanna said the board decided to add public interviews in response to community concerns. The board consciously responded to community feedback asking for a more transparent process, he said. As a result, the board is calling a special meeting to publicly interview all interested parties to ensure the focus is on candidate qualifications. According to the district's bylaws and state law, any vacancy occurring on a special district board shall be filled by a vote of the remaining board members. The selected candidate will serve the remainder of Pye's term, which ends in 2025, according to the district. At the board's April 17th meeting, Vice Chair Pam Eller read a statement announcing the resignation of Pye, who was not present at the meeting, Grubb said. A press release from the district said Pye chose to step away from her role to focus on her health. During Pye's time on the board, she supported the renovation of 3 outdoor pools, the opening of the South Suburban Sports Complex, and the completion of the 2022 Master's Plan update, according to the district. The Centennial Citizen has attempted to reach Pye for comment. Applications for the board seat will be available on the district's website on April 19th and must be submitted by interested candidates by 5 p.m. on May 15th. After reviewing applications, the board will publicly interview all candidates at a special meeting at 6 p.m. on May 22nd. Grubb said the completed candidate applications will be posted in the board packet for the May 22nd meeting. At the conclusion of the interviews, board members will vote on a person to fill the vacancy. Grubb said the board expects to swear in the new board member at its June 12th regular meeting. The board of directors is composed of 5 members who serve staggered 4-year terms with a term limit of 8 years, the district's website says. The board governs the 46-square-mile district that includes Littleton, Sheridan, Lone Tree, and parts of Centennial, Douglas County, Jefferson County, and Arapahoe County. To be eligible to serve on the board, a candidate must be registered to vote in Colorado. They also must be a resident of the district, own taxable property in the district, or be married to or in a civil union with someone who owns taxable property in the district. Candidates can submit applications via email to jking@ssprd.org or via email or in person to the South Suburban Sports Complex at 4810 East County Line Road. Mailed applications should be addressed to Attention, Jennifer King, 4810 East County Line Road, Littleton, Colorado 80126. Google, Rewiring America, and Governor Polis announce a new energy savings tool for Colorado households by Joe Davis. Governor Jared Polis recently announced a collaboration with Google.org and the nonprofit Rewiring America. They launched a tool to help Coloradans calculate their energy savings, the Colorado Energy Efficiency Upgrade Savings Calculator. The tool is funded by a $5 million grant from Google.org. With this new tool, Coloradans can easily access discounts on heat pumps, electric vehicles, solar power, and more. These clean energy upgrades save Coloradans money, potentially thousands of dollars, and will help Colorado achieve our climate goals to help future generations, said Governor Polis. The calculator was created to help families calculate their savings from upgrading to a more energy-efficient lifestyle. Those savings come from the many incentives and credits available from federal, state, and local sources, according to the governor's press release announcing the project. Tens of thousands of dollars in local, state, utility, and federal incentives make these zero-emission technologies more affordable and accessible, said Colorado Energy Officer Executive Director Will Tor. This easy-to-use tool will help Coloradans maximize these incentives to pay the lowest possible cost for home energy upgrades, which reduce pollution and save them money on utility costs. The calculator was the brainchild of the nonprofit Rewiring America and the Google.org Fellows. Rewiring America is an organization that promotes electrifying communities. According to the governor's announcement, the Google.org Fellows are a team of engineers, program managers, and other IT experts who work on pro bono projects. Collaborating with Rewiring America enabled our Google.org Fellows to support the creation of a cross-country impact by helping American households take advantage of these new electrification incentives. Bhavna Chhabra, Senior Director of Software Engineering and Google's Boulder office lead. It's a great example of how advanced technology, like AI, can be leveraged in a bold and responsive way. As a Coloradan, I'm proud that our state is leading on climate solutions at the household level. The savings calculator also has language translation capabilities and is designed to be easy to operate. The collaborators hope that the tool helps households reduce their climate impact without economic compromises. We're thrilled to launch this new tool in a state that is truly leading the way on residential electrification, thanks to Governor Polis' leadership and the effort of so many advocates. Ari Mateziak, CEO of Rewiring America. We look forward to continuing to work in partnership to make these important home upgrades more affordable and accessible to all. With this calculator, households in Colorado are only a few clicks away from the next steps on their electrification journey. To access the calculator, go to homes.rewiringamerica.org/calculator. Thank you for joining us for the Arapahoe County News. My name is Tim Elliott.
If you enjoyed this program, please register for our free services at www.aftersight.org or by calling 303-786-7777.